Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hello, I'm Mark Schwarzer and welcome to the Optusport Football Podcast. I'm joined today by former Socceroo Tommy Orr and, of course, as always, Phil Kitromilidis. Well, let's just get straight into it. I mean, there's only one game that we need to talk about right off the cuff, and that has to be Spurs against Arsenal. Phil, I mean, what happened?
I don't know, mate. You were there. I was watching Cadiz against Mallorca. I wasn't even watching. No, I wasn't. I mean, listen, you were there and you were doing it for UK radio, so you were analysing it more than I was. I was watching it as a fan, and it, from a fan's perspective, I thought it was a strange game because obviously Spurs started really well. And they actually possibly played better than Arsenal in that first half and went in losing 3-0. And then Arsenal in the second half asserted a bit more dominance and control. And Spurs somehow managed to get into it with a ridiculous mistake from my doppelganger, David Raya. So it just ebbed and flowed in a kind of strange way. From a Spurs perspective, it was disappointing to concede the goals that Spurs conceded because they were poor goals to concede. I felt it was very disappointing that we didn't take chances. And it was strange to see Christian Romero being the most dangerous player on the pitch for Spurs, which he literally was statistically. I think he had more shots on target. He scored, he hit the post. He was a real big threat. So all in all, it was a strange game from a Spurs perspective. From a neutral perspective, I think, you know, you guys watching on as neutrals, it had everything that you wanted from a North London derby, I would have thought.
Tommy, when I ask you, Ange well, you've worked under him. Was it a little bit surprising for you in the way that Spurs started, considering also they had about a 2-week break between their last game, which was a bad performance away at Newcastle, and of course then you have the massive North London derby?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I kind of agree with Phil and his take. I thought that, you know, the game where Spurs kind of fell short in this game, I think, was the details in both boxes. You know, defensively, you know, it's been a bit of a trend over the last kind of period, and in this game it was obviously plain to see, but, you know, offset pieces and in transition, they just look so vulnerable. And, you know, when you concede, it's such a, when you're playing well in the game, you're having good moments and creating chances, and then to get such a sucker punch at the other end, it's so deflating for a team. And I think that, you know, in the first half in particular, that was kind of the way that things unfolded, because, you know, for all Spurs' possession, and I think they had a lot more possession than Arsenal, particularly in the first half, but they weren't really able to create too many clear-cut chances, whereas every time Arsenal kind of went forward, you thought, you know, they looked very likely. And I think that was the main difference between the two sides. So, you know, going on off what you said from the start of the game, I thought that, you know, Spurs were going to start really quickly, but I think that the disappointing thing was that they hadn't really learned the lesson from the last period.
Sure, so you were in the stadium, right? And at 3-0 down in that second half, certainly watching it, it felt like the home fans had given up almost. It felt like they were not far off from maybe leaving. And then David Raya gives this gift and then everyone gets back into it and it kind of sets up. You knew what was going to happen. You knew Spurs were going to get a second goal and it was going to be a grandstand finish. But did you get that feeling in the stadium that even the fans were a little bit deflated around the 60-minute mark?
Yeah, I think if Arsenal had scored the fourth goal, I think there would have been a massive exodus. Coming back after the halftime break, going into the halftime break, I agree. I found it a really strange scoreline because I didn't think it was a true reflection of the way the game went. I don't think Arsenal were unbelievable, but I also think that Spurs made it easy for them by giving those two goals away. And also, there's moments in the game, right, where they attack. Kulusevski goes down in the box. He manages still to pass the ball just before he falls. And then Maddison goes down and there's a big call for a penalty and they go at the other end and that's where they score. So it's a sucker punch on top of everything else, right? So I was surprised at that. Immediately after the halftime break, when the second half began, there were a lot of empty seats. And I was listening to on the radio here locally in the UK after the game, and people were saying, oh, you know, Spurs fan, they left in their thousands and everything. They didn't. They just came out late. And they all did come. I mean, I think pretty much every one of them came back into the stadium. The stadium was packed within probably 5 to 10 minutes of that second half beginning. Had another goal gone
they
in
were at the bar.
Well, yeah. I mean, you've been to a Spurs game, and I mean, it's very understandable. There's a couple of times I went to the toilet and I was considering sitting in the bar for a while because it is so enticing. It's a fantastic stadium. I think if the fourth goal had gone in for Arsenal, then that would have been it. But like you said, they put a bit of pressure on Arsenal. Arsenal got a little bit, I thought, complacent. Yes, it's a big, big mistake from Raya. Bad mistake. Yep. But what was impressive, and Mikel Arteta alluded to it after the game, was he was really, really impressed with the way that Raya responded to that mistake. And I have to agree. I didn't see it from Raya before. I never thought that he dominated his 8-yard box as well as he did. Certainly the way he did it yesterday against Spurs. I mean, he dealt with everything that came in the box really, really well. So you've got to give him credit there. And I also said on the radio, look, he's made a massive mistake. They've opened the door for Spurs to come back into it. Spurs didn't capitalize. In the end, they get away with it. And yeah, he's made a mistake, but you move on and people kind of almost forget about it because it didn't cost him anything.
Yeah, yeah, totally. But I mean, listen, how can we analyse this sort of from general perspective of the two teams? So Spurs, I don't think, if we look at the broader picture, right? Broader picture, Spurs are probably going to finish fifth this season. In Ange Postecoglou's first season in charge, having sold the best striker in the club's history a day before the season started. Broader picture, this is actually a pretty good season for Spurs. I'd say a very good season. I'd say they've overachieved if they do indeed finish fifth, which I think they probably are. They're probably not going to finish fourth, which is like looking like it's just beyond them. It's a really, really good season in the first of what is supposed to be a project. The idea is that you trust Ange Postecoglou. The idea is that you bring in players that he wants in the summer to reinforce and play the way that they want to play. Because the first 11, broadly speaking, I think has got a good general grasp of how Spurs want to play. But maybe you need strength in depth, which the bigger clubs have, to be able to play the way that Ange wants to play. And then, you know, next season, they can mount a bigger challenge for top four, get into that top four and go deeper in the cup competitions with a stronger squad whilst managing European football. So broader picture for Spurs fans, and I know I am a Spurs fan. We are an Australian podcast, so maybe in theory we're not the most impartial, but we are trying to be impartial. And broad picture here, I think generally speaking, it is going to be a good season for Spurs, even if it feels like it's falling a little bit flat towards the end of the season.
Tommy, do you agree? Like, is it a good season for Spurs to finish fifth? I mean, if they finish fifth, obviously they've still got two games in hand from Villa. They're 7 points behind them. It's not done and dusted as yet. Is it enough? Yeah. Is it where at the end of the season, like Phil, as a Spurs fan, would be happy enough with it?
Well, I think that the press conference that Ange did before the game, I think, speaks volumes. And they asked him, would he accept the current situation that the team is in? And he said no. And I think that that kind of needs to be the mindset of the whole club as well. You know, obviously, you know, after a disastrous few years, it's been kind of a stabilizing season. And, you know, Ange has obviously instilled a lot of belief in and around the club with the fans. But I think that, you know, there is kind of the starting blocks to build something. But I don't think that they should be viewing this season as a success. They should want more. And I think that, you know, it's easy to kind of, you know, analyze and take the big picture. But I actually think in the kind of last few months, they've been a little bit more underwhelming. You know, if you look back towards Christmas, they were, you know, in the top of the table and in the first few positions, and everybody was talking about them. Are they title contenders? And, you know, to fall off the rails. And obviously Phil just touched on it, you know, talking about squad depth and these types of things. They're things that obviously they'll look to address. But overall, I think that the second half of their season has been a little bit more concerning than the first half, for sure.
Tommy, you've been in the dressing room after a game. You could see after the match how vividly frustrated Ange was and disappointed with the performance, certainly in that first 45 minutes. What is he saying in that dressing room after the game?
Yeah, well, I think that he was never one to talk straight after the game. Actually, that was one thing I remember about him. He was always one to kind of, you know, let the emotions kind of simmer down, and he'd always talk the next day after he's kind of had a look at the game and taken maybe a step back. But I think that he will be letting all the players know in no kind of uncertain terms where mistakes were made and who was accountable. I think that, you know, he'll be kind of, like I touched on before, I think we're starting to see a lot of the same mistakes happen in some of the games, which I'm sure will be frustrating him immensely. So I think that he'll probably be telling the players, you know, if you don't start to learn these lessons and improve in the upcoming games, you know, I'm going to have to put other players in that will. And I think that that's kind of one part of it. And I think that he will come down quite hard on the side here. But the other side of it is they've got another game, or two big games against Chelsea and Liverpool coming up, and you can't really dwell on it too long. So I think he'll be quick to, you know, put the hammer down. But I think, you know, the follow on from that, or from that meeting or that session, will be looking forward and moving on. So I think that's kind of how he'll navigate that.
He did make a quite a pointed comment, didn't he, after the game about Christian Romero, and say, you know, he's amazing, he's a World Cup winner, I just need him to, I just need some of the others to play a bit more like him, suggesting that there wasn't necessarily the Christian Romero-ness in some of the other players. So yeah, I thought that was quite a pointed comment actually.
What was interesting as well was that on the radio, I was alluding to it. Romero needs to stay calm. They're 3-0 down. This is prime for Romero to do something silly. He didn't, actually. Yeah. He was brilliant, and he went on. The other thing I have to make a note about is watching Mickey van der Ven in the flesh, seeing his pace was mind-blowing. Honestly, I still sat there, and there's not many times I sit in a game and I get surprised or shocked or really impressed by something, and his pace and ability to get back into position was off the charts, insane. And it was brilliant to watch. Let's move on to Arsenal. Arsenal have got three games left. Obviously, one game fewer than Manchester City. Man City only 1 point behind them. Has this shown Arsenal's maturity now? I mean, that's what's always been talked about. Arsenal last season, let's be honest, they fell apart. They bottled it, some people said. And the going got tough and they fell apart. Was this a real good indicator to show that Arsenal have matured, Arsenal there for the long haul, and can they win it, Tommy?
Well, I think that, you know, this season they've defensively kind of sorted out a lot of the issues. You know, I think going forward last season, they were fantastic, and they've obviously, you know, evolved and improved on that again this season. But you always had the feeling last season that, you know, in these games they were going to concede, and I think they've kind of addressed a lot of their issues off set pieces and the like this season. And for sure, they're a more kind of balanced side at both ends of the pitch. Whether or not, you know, their improvements are going to be enough to win the league, I mean, it's going to be interesting. I think that this was probably looming as the last game they had left. They've obviously still got to play United, which is obviously going to be a big game. But, you know, the Spurs game, I thought this was one that, you know, this could be season defining for Arsenal if they don't win this game. But as you mentioned, they've overcome that challenge. And I think that, you know, it's kind of, I don't think it's going to be enough for them to win the league. I think it's City's to lose, and I can't see them dropping any points. But at the same time, I think Arsenal's going to take them all the way to the end.
Thing is, it's not in Arsenal's hands now, is it? That's the thing. You can see Arsenal winning their remaining fixtures, but you can see City winning their remaining fixtures. And if that happens, then Manchester City will be champions. So that's the thing for Arsenal. They're relying on one of the most consistent and best teams we've ever seen in the Premier League to drop points, which is... which is a tough situation to be in. But yeah, there certainly seems like a level of maturity and development. And obviously, everybody remembers last season, at this point of the season, they didn't have William Saliba in the heart of defence. And I think him and the partnership that he's built with Gabriel has just been extraordinary, really, really, really superb. And they got over the line yesterday, and maybe in another situation they wouldn't have, and maybe last year they wouldn't have. You know, last year there were games where they threw it away at the end, you know, against West Ham, against Liverpool in that run, and they dropped points and they lost matches that they shouldn't have, and they managed to get that win. So that's obviously huge for Arsenal. Schwartz, can I ask you a question? Because obviously a lot has been made of Arsenal's goals from set pieces, and their set piece coach, Nicolas Jovert, is getting all sorts of plaudits, and rightly so. They've scored more goals from corners than anyone else. They scored set piece goals yesterday again. Is this a new thing, having a set piece coach, this specific work? Because everybody's talking about it now, but did you have a set piece coach? Was this something that was worked on when you were playing?
We didn't have a specific set piece coach, but obviously the assistant manager and normally the goalkeeping coach actually were heavily involved in organizing set plays. But what this has shown you is, again, I think it's confirmed it again because it's been confirmed so many times before. Other teams have had set piece coaches before, but for one reason or another, they never kind of followed through with it. They had them for a while. They never really, I don't think, really probably believed in it and really went with it. Whereas with Arsenal, you can clearly see it. Every time there's a set play, the set piece coach is at the fore of the, you know, that technical area. And clearly, watching Arsenal, they've worked incredibly hard on it, and it works, and it shows you that how important, again, or it reconfirms how important, again, set plays are and how much they can make a difference, how they can be game defining, match winning, season defining moments. And certainly that was for Arsenal yesterday. So I can see going forward, it's going to come back more. I can see it because it has to. I'm actually still always surprised how little detail goes in the set plays, certainly on the football pitch. Off the pitch, there seems to be a lot of detail, certainly in video analysis, but less on the pitch because it's a difficult one to go through, isn't it, Tommy? There's a lot of players standing around. So players, what managers don't want to do is have players standing around for long periods of time. They want it quick, short, sharp. And I think possibly with the newer generation of players, maybe that's just kind of seen as the norm now, that they will go through those things over a longer period. Do you see that as well, Tommy?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, looking on the flip side of defensive set pieces as an attacking player, it's always kind of a part of the game that you don't really look forward to, you know, working on it. It's not something that you train, especially, you know, people like Saka and, you know, these small kind of diminutive players, they wouldn't be looking forward to those situations. But as you mentioned, it's just such an important part of the game now. And, you know, I think that also, if you take a look at on the flip side from the Spurs perspective and Arsenal set pieces yesterday, for example, I know that Ange puts a lot of attention on set pieces. And, you know, I remember there being, you know, 20 kind of sheets of paper before you went onto the field in the change room, and you had to remember your role in every kind of situation. And I think the thing that would be frustrating him is that the players aren't following those instructions, because I have no doubt that they're spending a lot of time working on them and that every player knows what they're supposed to be doing. But either the plan isn't working, whatever the roles that the players are being assigned isn't working, or the players aren't understanding the roles. And I think that, you know, despite Arsenal being fantastic, I think Spurs looked so vulnerable and almost made it easier for Arsenal.
So you were saying with Ange, not only did you have all the information on paper, but did you actually go through it day to day on a training field or a couple of times at training? So there was a lot of detail in that as well.
There was a lot. So actually the session before the game, it would be, you know, a pretty short and sharp session, but the last 45 minutes of the session would be set pieces, and you would walk through every single set piece, corners from both sides, wide free kicks, central free kicks. And if there was any kind of questions or hesitation, you would keep repeating them until everybody was comfortable with the situation. So I would expect that Spurs would be doing the exact same thing right now. So the fact that it's still kind of an issue for them, I think, is quite alarming. You know, what the answer is, I'm not sure. I'm not privy to what their strategies are. But I think that, you know, Ange will be looking at that as a serious issue going forward.
So Manchester City, obviously, just behind Arsenal, 1 point behind with the game in hand. They played Nottingham Forest on the weekend, and there was potential for maybe a little bit of a slip up. Forest had some really, really good chances and just didn't. I mean, Chris Wood had two, basically tap-ins, and he missed them. And that's the difference. That's why Forest are where they are, and that's why City are as good as they are. And I think obviously I know the answer to this because we alluded to it now. We still feel that it's City to lose and they are in the driving seat, right?
Yeah, I mean, isn't just the narrative absolutely incredible that Manchester City's game in hand is at Spurs and a result for Spurs could hand Arsenal the title? I mean, we've talked about this being the best, the most dramatic Premier League title race that we can remember, certainly with three teams in it until this weekend, at this late stage of the season. But that would just be extraordinary if that could be another twist. But yeah, I think everybody fully expects Manchester City to win all their remaining games. I mean, they had a bit of a scare here, but even if Chris Wood had scored one of the two chances that they absolutely really should have scored, he still would have backed City to go on and get something out of this game just because it's Manchester City. And I think regular listeners to the podcast will know that earlier on in the season, I was questioning the validity of that argument. Our City are going to do it because it's Manchester City, because they're going to do it. And here I am literally saying that because they've worn me down with this ability to just get results. So, I can't see them dropping any more points, certainly not to Spurs.
I love how you change your mind as well each week, pretty much. So you Liverpool all the way, now it's City. And just because it's City, it's not going to happen, like you said. Tommy, it's brilliant, isn't it? Do you agree as well? Like, is it City? City know what they're doing?
No, I think that the best teams, in the world, you think of Real Madrid in the Champions League, for example, and City in the Premier League, they always find a way. So whatever challenges they're thrown, there'll be games. And as you mentioned, Forest definitely had their moments in this game and it could have been a slightly different story, but they always seem to manage the situation and come out on top. And it gets to a point where that's not luck. That's the players' know-how in these high-pressure moments and their experience shining through. And, they've got such big game players. And their know-how in this situation to see it through to the end of the season, I think, will come up trumps and we'll get them the title.
Radio Phil, the scene is set for the 14th of May. That could be the defining moment for City winning the title. Like you said, they're playing away at Spurs. As a Spurs fan, what do you want to happen in that game?
As a Spurs fan, literally just as a Spurs fan, maybe lose 5-0. Yeah.
So maybe. You would?
I don't know. Listen, because as long as, like I said at the start of the podcast, and maybe this is not the elite kind of mentality that club should be having, but I would take 5th Europa League in Ange's first season in charge and Arsenal not winning the league. That's fine for me. That is absolutely fine for me because we are bitter, petty people, Spurs fans. That's really, decades of underachievement and seeing Arsenal just be a bigger, well, more better run club has just ground us into this. So yeah, I would be happy. I would be happy for Spurs to live. All right, maybe not 5-0. Maybe not 5-0. Although the goal difference is actually important, isn't it? So yeah, maybe 5-0.
I can't believe that you're happy to go Thursday night's Europa League as opposed to going Tuesday and Wednesday Champions League. Even as a fan, going to Madrid, going to Paris, wherever it is, but you'd rather go, somewhere obscure and minute club in Eastern Europe.
Don't belittle the Europa League, my friend. Europa League is a great trophy, a great competition, one that we'd all love to be. But listen, obviously Spurs won Champions League, but I'm thinking now, if they were literally level on points with Aston Villa, then maybe things would be a little bit different. But I think Spurs are running out of steam.
You're only one point.
I can't see them. We're 7 points behind.
Yeah, but if you win those two games,
they've got the points on there. But they've got the points on the board, though. Yeah, I mean, I'm putting out my. You asked me what I thought as a fan, right? Okay. And this is what I feel in my heart. Like I said, and I know a lot of Spurs fans do, and I know I probably shouldn't be saying this on a podcast that's listened to by thousands of people around the world. But this is how I feel. Okay, I can't change how I feel, Swansea. I'm sorry.
Tommy, how do you feel about that? I mean, as a player, I'd be desperate to finish Champions League. I want to play Champions League next season. I'm of all people, right? I love the Europa League. I played it, UEFA Cup, Europa League. We had success, certainly in terms of getting to finals. But Champions League is Champions League, right, Tommy?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that if there was Champions League was on offer, I think it's a different discussion. But I think that the likelihood going into that game is that, it's more than likely that Spurs will already probably not be in contention. For that. So I think that, they've obviously got two huge games before then, Spurs, so it's such a difficult run in. But I actually think a lot of football fans have had the same opinion as Phil, a lot of Spurs fans.
I'm from North London, guys. Me, I'm born and raised in North London. This is just, it goes deep. It goes deep. I'm sorry.
Well, I think what I can say is, and I have a lot of Spurs friends, and I think that the only thing that makes them happier than winning is seeing Arsenal lose. So I think that's kind of the same thing, same question.
Schwartz's not impressed.
No, I understand it.
Small mentality.
No, I totally get it. I understand it. And that was a lot of discussion yesterday at the stadium. There were people, I heard people talking about it. It was a discussion on the radio. Most Spurs fans would probably be happy enough with finishing 5th so long as Arsenal don't win the title. I think for the Premier League, in terms of spreading the titles and not being a one-team league, it's great that someone else were to win it. But it is what it is. Liverpool, a team that obviously was hoping still to be involved, not only in the Premier League, but certainly a few other cup competitions, it didn't quite go to plan. they kind of stuttered again and splattered and kind of got away with it. They had a draw away at West Ham, which, let's be honest, for Liverpool, that is not a very good result. The big talking point, though, is Klopp v Salah spats. What did you make of it, Tommy? I've seen two different videos of it, right? I've seen two different angles. And one isn't particularly, one is, I think, it's kind of like you don't really know how it starts, why it starts, who started it. And the other one, I think, is quite conclusive as to why it starts. Have you seen both of them?
I haven't seen why it starts. The main thing I'm kind of following is Salah's reaction. And for me, you know, like, I've been in many situations where the coach has been very unhappy or yelled at me in a situation. And I think that it was never crossed my mind to react the way that Salah did. Especially publicly, you know, I think that behind closed doors, you know, I've seen many kind of situations where there's been confrontations between managers and players, but I think to do it in such a public domain and in that manner, I feel like was very disrespectful from Salah. You know, I think that I also think it was actually quite selfish because, you know, in a team environment, I can understand a player of his caliber and, you know, and of his standing, there would be a lot of frustration with not only results, but, you know, person on the bench in recent weeks. And I can imagine he'd be very angry. But at the same time, to react like that and to undermine the coach, I think is very selfish and has no kind of regard for your teammates. So for me, I'm fully kind of on the side of Klopp. And I think that Salah's actions were quite unacceptable, actually. So I think that, you know, for me, I don't really see where you can go from now in this situation because, you know, obviously we know how important of a player he is for the side, but, you know, you can't undermine the coach and kind of let a player get away with it for me.
I think that reaction has come from a number of things. Frustration from Mo Salah at not just not playing particularly well. He hasn't played well for the last couple of months, and you know, since the injury and coming back from AFCON, it's not been the Mo Salah that we've been expecting. And we actually saw that, didn't we, in this game right at the end. He was through. It's a great chance. There's a break with him and Darwin Nunez, and the pass he gives to Darwin Nunez is just not what you expect of Mo Salah. It did end up with a shot that hit the bar, but the pass was not good. And I think that was indicative of his performances. So personally, he's not at the level that he would expect. But he's a player who's not only played very well for many, many years, he's basically played almost every game for the last however many years. He's not someone who's used to being on the bench. So he's not playing particularly well. He's not used to being on the bench. The manager's going at the end of the season as well. It's just a whole cocktail of emotions that have led to this, I think, anyway. And yeah, I mean, the optics on this weren't good. Let's put it like from a marketing speak, the optics on this were really quite bad. And then I think Klopp tried to play it down afterwards. And then Salah comes out and says, if I speak, there will be fire. So that's not playing it down at all. And he's had time to calm down as well, Mo Salah. That wasn't immediately afterwards. And also, Salah is not someone that talks to the press. How many times have you seen Mo Salah speak to the press, say anything to the press? Anytime, he genuinely never speaks to the press. So for him to actually say that little one line, that's actually quite pointed as well. And he hadn't cooled down, he hadn't calmed down, and he did it quite specifically, I think. So yeah, not good at all.
Exactly what Phil just kind of said. Going further, you know, like a lot of Salah's, you know, exploits and great form over the last few seasons have been under Klopp and under the environment that Klopp created for him to flourish. So For Salah to react like this, given in the context of the history and their relationship over the last, you know, 5 years, is remarkable, really. So unless there's something that comes to light that we aren't sure about, I just can't see, you know, given Klopp's reputation and how respected he is amongst all players, seemingly, historically, see any situation where Salah is going to look good when more information comes out.
So the video I was alluding to was a video that was taken from someone in the stands, and it's Salah going up to be substituted on. Klopp goes over to shake his hand, give him the whole big high five and shake his hand. Salah leaves him hanging for some time and kind of ignores him. And then finally he does actually go across and he just sort of kind of pushes it. He doesn't really grab hold of it. And that's when Klopp says something to him. And that's then when there's the other video, original video that people kind of saw, where then Salah then says something and there's that argument that ensues. So there is obviously, he's very frustrated about not playing, like you guys were saying. And it's understandable to a large degree, considering his stature and what he's used to. But I agree, Tommy, it's It's so childlike. It's unacceptable. He shouldn't be doing that. A player of his experience shouldn't be showing that kind of disrespect towards the manager. I agree with you. And I think the way he could have done it was go out on the pitch and just tear it up and then, you know, then kind of whatever, point to his name, point to the fans, whatever, point to his chair, whatever it is, and just reconfirm that he's the number one and should have been there. So, but anyway, people do have emotions.
Have you guys ever done anything like that?
Oh, certainly not me. I was always one to kind of avoid those situations. I mean, you know, there was a lot of times where if I wasn't in the starting lineup or something and I'd be angry, you wouldn't let – it's not a personal decision. Do you know what I mean? You can't take things personally. And I think that, you know, there's no greater cause regardless of the player's ability than the team, actually. So, like I said before, I just think it's extremely selfish. And I've seen it a lot of times behind closed doors, and I don't think there's actually a problem with that. I think they can be healthy sometimes to get air these grievances, but I think doing it publicly, that was something I haven't seen before.
Actually. Yeah, that's the thing. Yeah, publicly, I think is the key to it, isn't it? And it's a point, obviously, where it's more about self-preservation, showing that, putting out his chest and going, I'm the man, I'm the one that should be playing, and he's the one that makes the decision to leave me out. I'm going to show everyone that how annoyed I am with that decision. And I agree with you. I totally agree. There's nothing wrong with going and banging on the manager's door and having an out with him. You know, having a discussion with him, even if it's a shouting match, whatever it is, get it off your chest and kind of try and move on with it, right? Some managers don't respond well to it. Some players don't respond well to it. So there is an element of you almost have to judge the situation, know whether your manager is able to take it or not, and vice versa, the manager with players. So it is a tough one. I've never done it publicly. I've had discussions behind closed doors, definitely.
Discussions in quotation marks.
Yeah, discussions in quotations. Yeah. But anyway,
do you think that Salah should be involved going forward now? Given what's happened on the weekend, would you include him if you were the manager?
I think it's a very different situation because Klopp is leaving at the end of the season. I think he just wants to finish on the best possible note he possibly can. If he were to just drop Salah altogether, then I think it just shines so much more light and attention on the situation. It's also going to all depend on what happens during the next couple of days, right? So they may have already had it out. They may have already fallen out. It may be beyond repair. Who knows? Klopp's a very emotional man. Salah's obviously an emotional man. So I think it really depends moving forward. If Klopp was staying, then I think he has a decision to make to say, well, okay, moving forward, is this repairable? Do I plan the future with Mo Salah as the manager or not? And obviously that goes on nicely to Arne Slot, who is the, by all accounts, pretty much certain going to be the next Liverpool manager. And he then has a big decision to make, whether or not he even worries about that, whether that he feels that affects him or not, well, only time will tell if he's instilled as the manager. Tommy, how much do you know of Arne Slot, and his reputation and the way he plays football? And do you also think he's a good fit for Liverpool?
Yeah, well, I was actually in the Netherlands a few weeks ago and attended a few matches and spoke to some old colleagues of mine, and his name came up quite a few times. You know, he's extremely well-respected in the Netherlands for what he's done, not only at Feyenoord now, but before that at AZ Alkmaar. He took the club to the next level, really. And I think that, you know, I actually think this is a little bit of a poison chalice, you know, Klopp leaving an aging Liverpool squad. I'm not sure it's you know, a great time to take over at Liverpool. I think there's some big issues that need kind of addressing. But if he is to be confirmed as the manager, I think he would be a great appointment. What I do know is that actually there is shades of Klopp about him. He's very charismatic in the media. You know, a lot of rival fans really warm to him. It's rare that you'll hear Ajax fans talk kindly about a final manager, but that's definitely the case with this man. You know, he's apparently, by all accounts, very obsessed with football. You know, he lives and breathes it. He knows every random stat from every game you can kind of think of. And I think that he's a good fit, to be honest. But I think that going forward, I hope that if he is confirmed, that Liverpool gives him the time. Because, like I said, I think this is going to be a really challenging kind of couple or transition period for Liverpool coming up. And I would hate to see, you know, the right manager kind of them hastily make any decision if they weren't to get off to a start that the fans expected.
Phil, have you got any concerns the fact that he's only ever, like, he play as a footballer, he only ever played his entire career in the Netherlands, and he's also only managed in the Netherlands? Is that a concern for you moving forward?
I don't want to sound like the many small-minded Premier League pundits and people who say he's got no experience in the Premier League. It's the best league in the world. It's a big step up. I mean, you know, Tommy who played there and then came to England, even though, you know, the different level, but it is a big step up. And it's not just that, it's the whole aspect of being Liverpool manager. And it's, you're not just replacing Jurgen Klopp, the manager, you're replacing Jurgen Klopp, the figurehead of the whole city. What? Half of the city. The way that he bought into not just being the manager of Liverpool, but what it meant to the people, like ideologically, sociologically, culturally, he was the perfect fit for this club. So there's that. There's the level of scrutiny and pressure. Fine, they're, you know, big club, big fan base, but they're not on the same level as Liverpool. So from that perspective, yeah, not necessarily from a football perspective that, you know, he won't be able to adapt, because I think, you know, as Tommy said, he's a well-respected, intelligent, tactically astute manager who should be able to get things going if he's given the right pieces. And I think, you know, Liverpool might need a few signings in the summer, might need a striker, might need a proper central defensive midfielder. But if they do things to build a team that he wants, you know, tactically, I think that they should have confidence in him. It's just everything else that comes with it, that, and you're not prepared for that, and you can't be prepared for that. There's no way of preparing for that.
And like you said, Tommy, he plays a similar high energy attacking football, deep lying midfielders, reliant on a lot of wingers. It's kind of a lot of Dutch managers, I think, in terms of the perception of Dutch managers and certainly the way they play football do. He's Feyenoord's side. He's married, yep, managed since 21-22 season. They currently boast the best defensive record in the league. And they've also scored the second most high number of goals in the league as well. So that bodes well also for the fact that Liverpool, you know, want to play high energy. Conceding goals has been a little bit of a problem recently, but they also have bundles of goals in them if they're all firing.
Yeah, I think, like you and Phil just touched on, I think tactically I don't see any issue with, you know, his appointment or potential appointment in the role. I think that, you know, he has all the kind of ingredients and he has all the expertise to be successful and to learn very quickly about some of the challenges that he hasn't come across yet in his career. I think that, you know, the expectations from Liverpool fans, I think that's going to be important, because, you know, you've had such a successful kind of stint with Klopp, but I think it's you kind of have to view this and remember how Klopp started when he was at Liverpool. You know, they had their moments and it was a little bit like Spurs now. You know, they're just inconsistent, and but it's clear that there's a bigger picture that they're working towards. And I think that he's capable of kind of, you know, growing into having some similar success, but as long as he's given the time and that people are patient with him, that's going to be, and you've seen it so many times when great managers leave clubs, you know, sometimes clubs can be quick to kind of, you know, move the next manager on if he's not immediately as successful as the previous manager. But I think that can be a little bit unfair sometimes.
You talk about your outrageous comments, Phil, that you've made on the podcast. One of them certainly looked like it was going to be about Iriola. First 9 games of the season, didn't win a game. Now Bournemouth are the highest ever Premier League points total, full stop, in the Premier League. 10th on 48 points with 3 to play, Arsenal away, Brentford home. Chelsea away, maybe won't go too much better than that, but how good has he been?
This good, Schwartzy. Since they didn't win the first 9 games of the season, since then, if the season started then, they'd be fifth. That good. They'd be fifth. I mean, it's really impressive. And obviously, it took the players a while to kind of understand what Iraola wanted from them and understand how he wanted to press and understand his idea of volume, getting volume into the box in terms of balls in and crosses and numbers and people. But now it's working, and it's worked. And talking about being underrated, I mean, I'm not sure Iraola is getting the credit that he necessarily deserves. Don't think that many people are talking about him, but allow me to be that person who's talking about him, because, yeah, I watched him last season. Obviously, the club I follow here in Madrid, Rayo Vallecano, he did an extraordinary job with them, and he's got a better squad at Bournemouth now. Potentially, he's up against more challenging opponents week in, week out, but it took him a while to reach the levels that he wanted. But yeah, this is a tremendous job from Andoni Iraola. Schwartzy, next season we're going to see one of your old clubs back in the Premier League, Leicester. They're going to be back on Optus Sport next season after they were promoted to the Premier League. A tremendous job that Enzo Maresca's done there.
No surprise. Is anyone surprised Leicester are back in the Premier League? I mean, highest budget, you know, wages, all sorts of stuff. And Maresca's done really, really well. He has. I mean, I know there is a little bit of unrest in the Leicester stands because of the style of football they sometimes play, that possession-based, sometimes overplaying. They did stutter a lot towards the back end of the season. Probably should have been done probably 2 months ago, the way they've been playing. But that's the Championship, right? Things can happen. But it's great to see them back. They're a big club, or certainly a club set up to play in the Premier League. But obviously this is where the challenge starts now, right? So how far are they off being a team that can sustain themselves back in the Premier League game? Only time will tell, but I think they're in a good position to give it a proper go. So I'm looking forward to seeing him back in the Premier League. Tommy, another... your old club, Ipswich. I mean, it's a remarkable story, really. Going, you know, promotion from First Division into the Championship, and now they're on the verge in the very next season of getting promoted back into the Premier League. I mean, that is just obscene. I don't think anybody ever saw it coming. They've got two games to go, so they've got one game in hand. They play Coventry tomorrow night, and they've got Huddersfield last game of the season. Will they do it?
He's hoping, you know. It's been a painful 15 or 20 years for Ipswich Town fans. You know, they were in the Championship, I think, for the longest period of any club. And then they obviously got relegated. And the job that McKenna's done to, as you mentioned, get back into the Championship and now be on the cusp of getting back into the Premier League is remarkable. You know, as you mentioned, the game against Coventry coming up is a really big one, and Leeds is hot on their heels. So there's still a lot to do, but I'm really hoping they can get it over the line, because I know how much it would mean to all the people back in Ipswich. And, you know, I think a lot of the younger generation these days wouldn't realise how much history Ipswich Town has as a club, and, you know, that they were European champions long ago. And I think that they are, you know, by all means a Premier League team, and that's where they belong. So it'd be amazing to see them back in the top flight.
Women's football wrap time. Another weekend of WSL action on Optus Sport. Here's Narelle and Ash with all the details.
Yeah, Schwartzy, City are not missing a beat in this title race at all, are they, Ash? Another big win over the weekend against Bristol City, but a pretty poor first half from City.
Yeah, they sort of took a while to get going. And, it, you know, in fairness to them, Bristol sort of not parked the bus, but they had a lot of defenders back. It's hard to break down. I just don't think City were moving the ball fast enough to sort of get the job done. And it took them ages to sort of get to that point. And it was one of our very own that took the chance that they needed, right?
Yeah, Mary Fowler with two goals. Cracking goals, by the way, both for different reasons. But I think a lot of people were worried because during the week we got confirmation that Bunny Shaw is out for the rest of the season. Remember, she is the league's leading goal scorer. And now maybe it seems like now she's out the way almost. Mary Fowler can really shine.
Yeah, exactly. Shaw's been stealing all the goals from the others, you know. Now it's time for Fowler to get a chance. And they sort of rotated that front three a little bit throughout the game. You know, Hemp and Kelly and Fowler all had a chance in that nine position. It wasn't until Fowler went into that nine position that they started getting the goals late in that second half. And I think she sort of floated into the spaces in between the lines that she needed to. And that first goal, like a cracker left foot, it was such a good goal. And I think that sort of gave them the impetus that they needed to sort of follow on with the rest of the game.
Well, at one point during the season, we were talking about maybe Mary Fowler will look elsewhere to play her football because she was starting and she wasn't starting. Now she's starting. How much of a step forward is this for Mary Fowler and I suppose her future at Manchester City? Do you think she will be happy there for another season?
I think so. She sort of like wrestled back that starting spot from Chloe Kelly for a little while there, didn't she? And, you know, Gareth Taylor's always been a big fan of her. I think heading into the season, he said that she could be the next Shaw for them. And, you know, it's not until now, later in the season, that we're really seeing her step up. And, you know, she's been doing great. And I hope that she, you know, continues it for next season and for us at the Olympics.
And heading into the end of this title race now, two rounds remaining. How important are goals going to be, do you think, when it comes down to it?
Well, City seem to just keep ticking through, don't they? The goal difference, it wouldn't be the first time the competition's been decided by goal difference, which is amazing. But, you know, was it Chelsea's got two games in hand and they're 7 goals behind at the moment. So as long as City keep ticking through and keep sort of getting the results and getting goals, they'll be sitting pretty happy with where they are at the moment.
Shortsy Fowler is crucial to Manchester City's title race and definitely putting her best foot forward heading into next season.
Well, you know what? I think the minute that Bunny Shaw was seen to be leaving the ground a couple of weeks ago on crutches and a boot around her ankle, I think was pretty obvious for me anyway, that this is a massive opportunity for Mary Fowler. I mean, I know she's been playing quite a bit as well, but generally out wide. And I don't feel that that's her best position. And lo and behold, on the weekend, she starts the first 45 minutes, plays out wide on the right. And then second half, she's through the middle as a number 9. And what happens? She scores 2 fantastic goals. The first one was a screamer from distance into the top left-hand corner. What a strike it was. And that was to break the deadlock against Bristol City. And they were quite stubborn and City missed quite a few chances. But that goal for Mary Fowler changed the game completely. And then she scored a really good second goal where she got into a really good run into the near post. Delivery was great and she got on the end of it. It was a proper poacher's striker's goal. I'm not surprised. And I think she's a player that I think wholeheartedly fits going through the middle. But the problem is if you've got Bunny Shaw on your side and the amount of goals that she scores per season, it's really tough to replace her or even to compete against her. But Mary Fowler, what a player that you can rely on, that you can bring into the side. You can move from a winger to a number 9. She is top class. Phil, at that time again, we're talking about La Liga and obviously the biggest news coming out of Spain, other than Real Madrid going on to win the title and take it back off Barcelona, which just seems to be swinging both ways every time, is obviously Xavi. Xavi staying at Barcelona. I mean, you said it for a number of months now. No, he's not staying. He's going. He's definitely not staying. Now he's staying.
Yeah, it wasn't just me that was saying it, Schwartz. It was Xavi himself.
Don't have to defend yourself. I'm just saying that's what you were saying. I'm just repeating what you were saying.
Well, I was just repeating what he was saying. You know, I was giving you information straight from the horse's mouth that Xavi was saying, no, I'm not going. I'm not staying. No, not even if we win the Champions League. It's an irreversible decision. And it turns out it was actually a reversible decision. Listen, this makes sense for Barcelona. This is Xavi getting them out of a bit of a difficult situation because he announced on the 27th of January that he was leaving at the end of the season. His contract, he would rescind his contract on the 30th of June. So what do Barcelona do then? Because they don't have the money to attract a big manager. Not that there are too many big names out on the market and available, but, you know, for example, go and get Thomas Tuchel or bring in Hansi Flick. They don't have the money to be able to attract someone like that. So then do you promote Rafa Márquez, who is the current B-team boss? That's a big gamble. So, you know, it was a difficult position that he left the club in. I think he's spoken to the club. I think he initially said that he was leaving, I think because he felt that he was going to be sacked. And he was like, right, before they sack me, I'm gonna say that I'm leaving. And see if we get a little result, see if that can spark us into life. And that was the reason he gave. He said, I'm going because I think it's the best thing for the team. And I think it will change the dynamic of the team. And it kind of did in terms of them going on a relatively long unbeaten run and being very, very close to making it into the Champions League semi-final. But here we are. He said that he's staying and they are 14 points behind Real Madrid, and they're out of the Champions League in the quarterfinals. So from a footballing decision, it's not necessarily the best one for Barcelona. From a club and institutional decision, I think it's the one that makes sense. Because like I said, their financial situation is so catastrophic. I cannot underline how bad their finances are. They have to sell more stuff. This summer, they have to sell more players. They have to try and balance the books before they can even start signing anyone. And it's really, really bad. So this is one less problem for them, I guess, to have Xavi staying, sticking around for at least one more season and see what they can do. But yeah, it just shows that they're just at institutional level, they're constantly improvising, constantly. There doesn't seem to be a coherent, well thought out plan to try and take this club forward. And it's just another strange decision and strange move from Barcelona.
You know, we exactly as Phil just mentioned, it seems with Barcelona, they're constantly kicking the can down the road, and it's only a matter of time before it's going to catch up with them. So to see them kind of make these erratic, seemingly random decisions is quite frustrating. And I'm not even a Barcelona fan per se, but, you know, having followed them obviously a lot over the last 15 to 20 years, I think it's frustrating to see, because you would like to see a situation where, you know, they're maybe investing more in their academy and promoting those players and trying to get back to where they were 5 or 6 years ago. But instead, it feels like they're just making these short-term decisions that's going to come back to bite them, and they're digging themselves actually into a deeper hole, seemingly. You know, when I think of Barcelona now as a football club, I think of the politics and all these types of things, and the football's a secondary thought, whereas, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, it was the complete opposite, and I think it's a big shame.
Phil, is it a case with Barcelona? Because, I mean, logically, I'm thinking they get rid of all the big name players, like as in the older big name, not the players that came through the academy, the others, get rid of the rest, whether it's Lewandowski, whether all the big name players and the big earners, and promote within, like Tommy was saying, even more than they've already done, but even more. And then they may finish outside the top 4 or 5 for a couple of seasons, but then that would potentially stabilize them financially? Or is it a case of it won't, it'll make things worse because they've got such huge debt and it'll just keep mounting if they don't finish Champions League and progress further? Is that the case?
Yeah. There's that as well. Listen, I mean, for them to finish outside of the Champions League in Spain would be extremely unlikely and absolutely catastrophic financially. I mean, even more so. That's not even being contemplated. Like, they have to finish in Champions League positions. Getting rid of players isn't that easy. Like, they tried to sell Frenkie de Jong to Manchester United. Like, they wanted to sell Frenkie de Jong to Manchester United. He did not want to leave. And if a player has a contract and he's well playing and he likes his life in Barcelona, most people do. It's a lovely place to play. You're playing in the biggest stadium in Europe when they're actually at the Camp Nou. Like, it is attractive for players, particularly on good wages. So it's difficult to get rid of players. So it's not necessarily as easy as that, you know, oh, we'll just sell them. If someone doesn't want to go, they don't necessarily go. It's so deep, Schwartzy. Like, the problems are so deep. And they sold off a good chunk of their TV rights for the next couple of decades. So they're going to be making 25% less money than Real Madrid for the next 20 years in terms of TV money, just for a short-term cash injection, which went into signing players, which was supposed to give them on-the-pitch success. And yeah, they won the league last season, but now they're 14 points off of Real Madrid and out of the Champions League in the quarterfinals and didn't qualify for the very lucrative Club World Cup. So it hasn't worked. They're objectively speaking in a worse financial position now than they were when Joan Laporta took over. So yeah, it's really bad. I want to get your guys' perspective from a player's view. If the manager says he's going in January and then 4 months later I'm going to stay for another year. We'll see what happens. How does that affect the players? It must change everything. I don't know. It's just, it seems such a bizarre thing for fans and for journalists watching, but for players, how would you react to that?
Yeah, well, I think that it was the thing that makes that, makes Xavi announced his departure. And, you know, it seemed like it was a fairly kind of toxic relationship he had with the club and these types of things. And I think that from a player's perspective, Xavi kind of, you know, making that announcement and depart and saying he's going to leave at the end of the season kind of maybe would have rallied the troops somewhat. So for him now, after a really difficult few weeks, obviously, as you mentioned, out of the Champions League, losing some massive matches, it seemed the timing is odd. And I think that from a player's perspective, it would be very distracting right now. And, you know, as we mentioned before with Everton, how off-field distractions can be really detrimental to a playing group. And right now at Barcelona, there seems to be more than ever. And with this whole Xavi saga, I think that that's kind of just another chapter in what is unfolding at the club. And for me, it doesn't make sense the way it's unfolded. And for me, I'm sure there's more to it than what we know. There has to be, because it's not really logical. It doesn't make sense the way that it's transpired, to be honest.
But I think it's that financial thing, right? That's the basis of it, right? I think the fact that he's been there, done it, ex-player, he won the league with them. He's got that experience in terms of the knowing of the club and the financial constraints that the club have. They're desperate. They can't find anyone or afford to bring someone in that's going to be able to fill those shoes. So I think from that element, it does make sense. I think him announcing that he's standing down in January worked a number of ways, and that was the pressure on him, the scrutiny that he was on after every game, that it wasn't good enough. And like Phil was alluding to, that he probably felt that he was possibly going to be sacked anyway, so he wanted to beat the bullet himself. That did alleviate a lot of the pressures. From the outside, it certainly seemed so. People stopped talking about whether Xavi's job's on the line or not, because he's made it very clear where he stood with it. Now it's back on again. So what will be interesting, they play tonight, don't they, European time against Valencia. And it'll be interesting to see what the response is like, because you'll know within the group whether players, by the way they go out and play, whether or not the players are actually really on board with it and happy with it and the way they play, or they feel like, oh no. Real Madrid won on Friday night, 1-0. So title's done, right, Phil? You said it was done pretty much last week when they beat Barcelona.
Yeah, it's done,
right? So no problem.
It's done. Arda Güler scoring the only goal of the game, the young Turkish international getting his first start of the season and showing, you know, glimpses of skill. He got booked for dissent and could actually have been sent off on another night. So obviously he's got stuff to learn, but he's only 19, raw talent. And interesting to see whether or not he sticks around this next season or goes out on loan, because I think he's only played about 180 minutes or something this season. So it's not necessarily enough for him. But he scored 2 goals this season, and he was the match winner for Real Madrid against Real Sociedad.
Other news is that in the game Atletico de Madrid against Athletic Club Bilbao, Nico Williams has come out afterwards and accused Atletico fans of racism. Phil, what have you heard about it? What have you seen about it? Have you heard anything? Is it something that's still being ongoing and investigated at the moment?
Yeah, unfortunately, this is something that has happened again here in Spain. He heard monkey chants when he went to take a corner, and credit to him, he went over and he asked the referee to stop the game. The anti-racism protocol was then implemented. The game was stopped for 6 minutes while Tannoy speaker system made announcements to the fans to stop all the racism, please. So the game then continued after a 6 minute delay. I just don't know where to go from this in terms of an analysis perspective, because here we are again, and I've been living and working in Spain for the last 12 years, and this is a situation that is continuing to happen. Now, how do we solve racism is a very big question that I am not someone who is able to come close to answering that, but it is a societal problem, and I think that you can't solve racism. You can't. I think there will always be people that fear the unknown, fear something different wherever you are across the world. And let's not forget, racism exists everywhere in the world, even enlightened, more developed countries in terms of immigration, like the United States, like Australia, like the UK. There is racism everywhere. So it's something that a society as a whole has to try and work on. What is different here in Spain is that footballers, black footballers, go to their place of work with the fear of being racially abused. And that is something that has not been eradicated yet, which we've seen in other parts of the world where there may be racism, but in terms of footballers in their place of work, they've worked hard to try and eradicate it there. La Liga are doing stuff. There are campaigns, there are social media campaigns, there are hashtags, there is this protocol now. But it has to come from society, I feel like, as people have to begin to understand that this is not only not acceptable, but you have to play your part in it as well. And what do I mean by that? I am haunted by something that happened to me at a game a couple of years ago. It was a Champions League game, Atletico Madrid against Liverpool. I went to the Atletico Madrid stadium and I was sitting next to a guy and he said something to Naby Keita, screamed at it, and I didn't say anything to him. And I should have. And I had to say something and I didn't. And I'm still haunted by the fact that I didn't say something to this day. We're talking about 2 or 3 years ago. Nobody else said anything, obviously, but I should have. And until people like me start saying some stuff, that is how you change this, by making people aware of just how unacceptable this is. Because Spain is a country that is different in where it is in its path of immigration and multiculturalism. This was a country in the 21st century which had a 40-year dictatorship. Nobody came in, not many people went out. So in terms of opening up people's minds, they are behind in that development. The good thing is that there are more people from outside countries that have come and made Spain their home. So I think we are seeing, as we get older, young people from different backgrounds integrated into football, integrated to different parts of society, and it's a process. And hopefully we will get to a point where Spanish footballers can go to a stadium and not worry about racist abuse, but we're not there yet. And it's going to take time, and it's going to take, like I said, the integration that is slowly happening here, which has happened much slower than in other countries. I think that's the only way that this can change. But it is just, and you know, I've gone on for a while about this, but this is a real something that is it's not a bugbear. It is something that speaks to me in my soul about living here in Spain. It is very, very difficult to come to terms with listening to these kind of things and listening to these kind of comments in all walks of life here. So yeah, hopefully we're on the right path, but this kind of stuff shows that we've still got a long way to go.
Yeah, I think that obviously you mentioned it's a reflection of a bigger cultural issue, but do you think that, you know, I saw in this case that Atletico and La Liga both made statements condemning the behaviour, but do you think that goes far enough? You know, I think that a statement, obviously, without actions to kind of back up those statements, or like tangible things, actions to be done to minimise it, I think that there needs to be financial sanctions, you know, playing without crowds, these types of things on the table. Because, you know, when the threat of that happening is real, I think that all of a sudden the rest of the crowd almost become the police, because they're not going to allow that to transpire. And I think that you need to create an environment where it's self-policed. And I think that it's obviously disgusting, but I think that more needs to be done in Spain around those things and having bigger repercussions in the stadiums for this happening to stop it. Because I think that, you know, a lot of European countries are very multicultural and face a lot of the same issues, but it doesn't seem to be quite as prevalent. And I think the way they deal with it in a more heavy-handed manner helps deal with that situation. So I'd like to see La Liga and the clubs take more responsibility, to be honest, and be more heavy-handed and, with the sanctions, I guess.
Can you see that happening, Phil? Can you see the clubs not only just releasing statements and condemning the supporters, but is there a possibility of them starting to single people out to make examples of them, to press charges and so forth?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that happened. We saw with the actions against Vinicius last year in Valencia, people were singled out, people were charged and banned for life. But I think what Tommy is saying is it's possibly the only way you're going to try and stop this. And like I said, these, I think these are two different points: trying to cure society of racism and trying to make sure that in football we don't hear this and black players can go to their place of work without doing that. And to do that, maybe the heavy-handed approach is the right way, even if it's just one guy. And that is the argument that you hear: oh, it's just one stupid guy who doesn't represent our fan base. Okay, but if that one guy is doing it, and if there is that kind of sanction that Tommy is talking about, maybe it will be a deterrent. So maybe only the, you know, close the stadium. Like, you're not playing with fans. One guy does a monkey chant, done, finished. No fans the next game. Then maybe there is the notion of self-policing. And at the very least, people who think these disgusting, absurd things won't have the courage to say them in a football environment.
That's all we've got time for this week. Thanks for listening to the Optusport Football Podcast. And remember, Optusport is the only place to watch the conclusion of the Premier League, La Liga and WSL seasons. And then Optusport has the exclusive rights to the Euros and Copa America in June as well. See you next time.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.